Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. You're going to be watching the video version of the audio podcast that we did with Steve Snyder, who recently wrote a book called Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. Really cool, really interesting book. If you guys want to know more about us or about the show, please click some of the links down below in the description of the video. If you want to pick up Steve's book, which I highly, highly recommend, it's a really cool account of a story from World War II that is one of the most interesting ones I've ever read. We went ahead and put the link to Amazon so you can purchase his book right there. So hope you guys enjoy it. Please check out Steve's book and please check out more episodes of the Lefty Greg Show. Thanks. All right, everyone, thanks for tuning in. Today we've got a special guest on the show by the name of Steve Snyder. Steve Snyder is, like we kind of already mentioned, he's a author, historian, and he's here to talk about his book titled Shot Down, and it's the true story of pilot Howard Snyder, his father, and the crew of a B-17 named Susan Ruth that was fighting in World War II. So, Steve, appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much. Book is super interesting. We'll get into all, you know, a bunch of different areas with it and how we relate human behavior and human performance to it. But we'd love to have you kind of start off and kind of tell us a little bit about, you know, yourself and the book and, you know, what your plans are with it and everything that you've got going on right now.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. Well, I live in Southern California, Seal Beach, which is in Orange County, about 40 miles south of Los Angeles. I was born and raised in Pasadena, California. I graduated from UCLA. And I had a 40-year career in sales and sales management. Last 36 was working for a company called Vision Service Plan, VSP, which provides vision care as an employee benefit that corporations offer their employees to cover eye exam classes and contact lenses. And I retired from there in 2009, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. Growing up, I knew the basics. I knew my dad was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. Flew bombing missions over Europe, and in February of 1944, his plane was attacked by a couple German fighters, shot down. He was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England and back to the States. And so when I retired, I just wanted to delve in and find out more details. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years. As orders and letters, and there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, and it is absolutely riveting. It's in the book, and the other item was all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And he was really candid in those letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, talked about what life was like on the airfield and the base, what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And reading those letters, as I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, it became my passion. And I started reading book after book about the air rover Europe. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listened to veterans tell their stories, spent hours on the internet doing research. And finally, 3 years into it, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, if I might, Brian and Steve, Greg. Thank you so much for being on the show. There's a funny lineage. We believe in the string theory here on Left of Greg, because everything has a purpose, and it's funny how this web starts to form. So Shelley's father, God rest his soul, he died just a few months back. My wife's father, and she's the CEO of the company, huge B-17 buff. I told you this when we were talking before via email, and no other plane and no other list of heroes could stand up to him. And so my brother Jeff and I My family was born in Detroit. We used to have to commute out to Willow Run, which is a little airfield back then, where they built the B-24 Liberators back in the day. So I was a huge fan of the B-24, fascinated by Ford Motor Company and how they put things together with the Civil Air Patrol back there. My brother went towards pilot and got his pilot's license, the second youngest private pilot's license in Michigan history. The first, I even remember the guy's name, was William Charles Blackaby III. And then I went to the search and rescue. So many years later, coming out of Red Devil, I was teaching a search and rescue course at the Air Force Academy for Peterson Air Force Base, Air Force Academy. And gosh, what's the big tunnel up there that keeps track of Santa every year? I just can't think of it, about outside of Colorado Springs.
NORAD.
NORAD, the NORADCOM, you know. And so there they had actual B-1 bombers and B-52s. And I actually got to go inside a B-52 and look around. When your book came out, I've got three books. I've always got a run book in the gym. I've got a bathroom book, and then I've got a bedroom book. And one's for fun, one's for technical stuff. When your book came out, I picked it up, and I must tell you, Steve, I was riveted. From the jump, from the very beginning of the book, you talk about your dad's divided attention and his cognition bias when he had set up his gear in a specific way. And all of a sudden, when he knew the alarms are going off and the B-17 is gone, going down, and he's worried about everybody else, and he can't get his parachute on. I had a very similar experience in an Osprey in Afghanistan where I was petrified and I was tying the seatbelt together. So you had me at hello. I ran a couple extra miles that morning, and I immediately got on the phone with Brian, and I said, Marin, you have to read this book. What I love, sir, in addition to everything that your father did and all the stuff that you did, there's so much stuff that I took from it in my life, in my history, even though I wasn't around World War II. I thought of my dad. I thought of Shelley's dad. I also thought of how this relates to resilience, how it relates to John Boyd's OODA loop. There's so much in the book, and it's as much technical as it is a romance novel, and it's as scary as it is informative. So, Marin, what was your takeaway? Did you see those points?
No, that was a kind of other thing I was going to hit at. So my only history with the B-17 would be watching the movie Memphis Belle when I was a kid, and thinking it was really cool, and then watching stuff on the History Channel about it back when the History Channel actually used to put on shows about the history, not just, I think they just do like Bigfoot and stuff now anyway, but you know,
it's our next episode for anybody tuning in. We'll do an equal time on Bigfoot.
So, but you know, obviously, you know, in movies, it doesn't matter, war movies, right? I was in the Marine Corps. Greg was in the Army and then law enforcement. I know you served in National Guard as well too. And you know, you get it's very romanticized. And then when you find out what these guys actually went through up there in an unpressurized cockpit, getting shot at, freezing cold, you're going, this is unbelievable. You know, it takes my own experience to go, well, maybe that heat out in the desert of Iraq really wasn't that bad. So that was mine. But weaved in there too is like Greg said, you have the story of you know, your dad who's, you know, missing for 7 months. We can get into that a little bit. And then you also weave in all the technical details and the history of just the plane itself. So it's like, it's a really cool story within a very detailed, researched,
yes, absolutely,
like timeline of how everything works. So I don't know how you kind of came up with that format or what your plan was for the book. How did you want to tell that story?
Well, I didn't want the book to be another war book for guys. I wanted it to appeal to, you know, World War II buffs and history buffs, but I also wanted to appeal to the general public as well, and to make it a story about, you know, the people and their lives. So it's kind of like you say, two books in one. It's the story of my dad and his crew, which really reads like a novel, even though it's all based on firsthand testimony. And then what I added, like you alluded to, was just a lot of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it in context and give it background. So it's kind of like reads like a novel and a history book kind of combined into one. So I'm glad that came across to you.
Easily.
I was going to say, I think it was three books. I got, you get right. the novel, you get the technical data, and you get the history of World War II in there. So it's.
I think there's even one more, Brian. I think, Steve, what I think came across, and I'd love to ask you about this. I think there's a love story that's in there too, because it's about your dad and his love of his family, certainly the love of your mom. Here's my thing. My dad, 1st Marine Division, Raider Battalion, World War II, Island Hopper, meanest human being I've ever met, but he instilled in me the values of loyalty and truth and honesty and dedication and courage and all these other wonderful things. But I've asked my mom, who now has just the horrible dementia and Alzheimer's, I asked my mom many times, hey, was dad romantic? She's like, oh, he's the most romantic guy in the world. And he used to send me letters and he used to do these things. I never saw that side of my dad. How was it during your research? Was your dad always that guy, or was that one more thing that you discovered during your research?
Well, a couple things. One, my dad and or my sisters and myself, I have two older sisters, one Susan Ruth, who was the plane was named after.
Named after.
And then my other sister was actually born while my dad was missing in action.
Right.
But we always looked at my dad like John Wayne, or if you remember the old Gunsmoke TV series, James Arness.
Yep.
You know, he was a big guy, no-nonsense guy, but he was a very loving father, and he was my parents had, you know, what to me was the ideal marriage. They loved each other deeply. That was just the epitome of what, you know, I dreamt about, that, you know, one day I could have a marriage like that. So they were very romantic. They were very loving. They showed a lot of affection for one another. So he was a great role model for me in a lot of different ways.
That's incredible. Just so you know, and you might know this, Steve, Marin has been married twice, and he's still looking for that. So hopefully on this marriage, he just got married a month ago. Hopefully on this marriage, it's going to be that same type of relationship. But Marin and I also share that we come from fathers where the father was the rule of the roost, and my dad knew how to say he loved you with the back of his hand. But again, I just fell in love with the love in the novel. My mom, first generation German, she was under many of those bombs. She lived in Little Königsberg, and we actually toured her hometown and got to see Hofheim and Hosfurt and Schweinfurt and all the places devastated by bombing. And you don't really see the full picture until you see it that way. And you did that, sir. You went to all these locations and you got to walk on the ground and interview the people and see those locations. And Brian and I have been to a number of countries and been lucky enough to see that. What was it like to walk in the shoes of your dad when you were doing that research? How did that affect you?
Oh, it's just incredible. I've been to Belgium 6 times. I just got back actually from my 6th visit to attend the 75th anniversary celebrations of the liberation of Belgium and my dad's plane being shot down. And every time I go to Belgium, I find something new, little pieces of the puzzle. But I'm so fortunate, like you said, to be in these places where history took place. And I just went to a new one on this last trip. I've been trying to find the farmhouse of the Franken family who hid my dad, and the location, and actually they found out it was right under my nose the whole time.
Oh, wow.
We just didn't recognize the building, but we finally did on this trip. And then when I go, there's a Belgian gentleman, Jacques Lalot, who I probably wouldn't have written the book without his help. He kind of acts as an interpreter. And so we finally recognized the building, and we went in and talked to the people there. They couldn't speak any English. But Jacques talked to him, and I said, well, can I go see the room where my dad was hidden in? Because the Frankens had sent pictures of the farmhouse from World War II after the war and put a little arrow like, this is the room where he stayed. And so she goes, okay. So we went up the stairs in the second floor and went in this little room that was, I could almost touch both walls, you know, putting my arms out. And to see that's where my dad was hidden for 10 days in that room when he looked out that window. And so I get goosebumps just talking about it now.
Right.
To be in these places where he was 75 years ago and where he was hiding from the Germans, and just, you can't, just imagine, you know, his anxiety, the tension,
right,
the fear, whatever that was he was experiencing at the time. So it is just amazing to visit these places.
Well, and what was that? So I know you, because you just kind of mentioned another gentleman. You said that, you know, without it, I might not have written it. So what was that moment when you're just, because you're right, doing all this research, because it's cool, it's your family, it's your dad, and you're reading through everything. So what was that moment that you went, you know what, I gotta write a book. I gotta document this. I gotta learn every bit of information. What was that for you? How did you get there?
Well, Jacques Lalonde and another gentleman, Dr. Paul Delahaye, they were young boys during the war. They were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed against family and friends. And later on in life, they both became kind of local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information, as you know, that's in the book that would have been lost forever.
Right.
About their dedicated right. research. So I owe both of those men a huge debt. Dr. Delahaye passed away in 2013 at 82. Jacques now 83. And so a great man. And so I probably wouldn't have written a book without their research. And Jacques is a dear friend of mine. Dr. Delahaye was a dear friend of my dad's, and I knew him, and his actually daughters and son carry on this association that he founded in the mid-80s.
Yep. Now, to talk about resilience in that moment, sir, what one of the things, and I don't want to give away too much of the book, because I want our readers and listeners, certainly viewers and listeners, certainly to get this book, because I was fascinated by it. And I read it all in one 24-hour period. I could not put it down once I was captured. There's a scene where a section in the book where a scene, because I spend most of my time.
It's a book. You know, it's not a movie.
It could be a movie. I tell you what, it'd be four exciting movies. But there was a part of the book where your dad says, okay, I have to record this. I know that this is a novel experience. I know that we're together for a reason. I know that we're escaping, and the resistance has now made a decision to hide us and aid. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to keep what he was writing, but he didn't want it to be discovered and then jeopardize the people that were trying to hide him. And the guy that was hiding him said, hey, pal, that's the least of our worries with all the other stuff that we're hiding. A pivotal moment and a testament to thinking on your feet, even while you're running, even while you're fleeing and being,
right,
you know, to say, hey, I'm going to jot this stuff down for posterity. What a great moment.
Yeah, and And to get that diary back that he wrote,
exactly,
he just wrote it on these little pieces of paper, and you know, he left it there, or I don't know exactly if he left it there or lost it, but to have an army lieutenant, you know, after the war, be given this diary that my dad wrote by one of the people that hit him, and then he mailed it back to my mother. Right. And I have it today, is incredible. You know, there's so many incredible little stories within the whole, you know, broad story.
Exactly.
Well, and what's that? I mean, obviously without giving too much away, do you have a favorite part or something that you love to tell, or a little snippet of one of these stories or the book that you want to share with everyone to kind of set that hook and sound, you know, hey, get interest. What is that for you? Like, what's your favorite part of the whole story?
Oh gosh.
That's called being ambushed, Steve.
Yeah.
he set you up and ambushed you.
That's pretty hard for me to think.
I imagine.
As far as my dad's concerned, just the amazing decision that he made while he was being hidden. He could have stayed hidden and just hunkered down and waited it out until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day to be liberated. That was the safest thing to do, but word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy and that he knew they would be working their way up. And rather than just stay hidden, he decided to get back in the fight and risk his life joining the French resistance and fighting the Germans and sabotaging German convoys. because he could have easily been killed in the fighting against the Germans, or if they had have captured him, he would have been shot on the spot as being a terrorist. So right. There's not too many people, and I don't know whether I could have done it, who would have made that decision to leave relative safety, because he had several close calls of being discovered by the Gestapo, but to leave that safe haven and go and join this group of French resistance guerrillas who, you know, they didn't know him from Adam, and to get back in the fight is just pretty incredible.
Yep. For our listeners, the Gestapo, the Geheimstaatspolizei from the Germans, brutal home, like a state police type version, those, and obviously the Luftwaffe shooting down the planes and the SS on the ground, take no prisoners attitude at this point, specifically with the resistance, make a difference by killing them. And I'd like to liken something to you, Steve. One of the things Brian and I, sadly, are no strangers to danger in our careers or in our lives. But a person asked me one time, do you have like this gradient scale that once you've saved a life or done something that others would consider heroic? Certainly I wouldn't. I'm a humble guy and I just was thrust into some weird situations. But they say, does it get easier? And I would challenge, and I'd be interested in Brian and Steve, your reaction to this. It never gets easier. Every single time my life was in peril, there was another set of decisions that I had to make at that exact moment, whether, wow, this really could be life or death. And if I make the wrong decision, a lot of people, including myself, are going to die. So I think it's arduous every single time you get in that situation, which is why I never want to stop training or educating people. Brian, do you see it that way as well? Or?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, the story kind of reminds me, Steve, is like, you know, you got certain people out there. There's certain guys out there and girls out there, you know, that whether they serve, whether it's law enforcement, fire, you know, military, we've seen it in different parts of my career spanning, working with all kinds of folks, is that they're kind of just made for that moment and for what they're doing. It sounds like that's who your father was, where it's like, okay, he gets shot down. Now he's on the run. Well, now he decides to keep fighting. Now he's going to continue documenting it. You're like, so he's not just reacting to things that are going on in Byron.
Exactly.
He's actively saying, what else can I do given the circumstances that I'm in? And when you see people like that aren't just, hey, just in a chaotic situation and trying to make the best of it. So he didn't just survive. He actually thrived in this situation.
And not just an individual skill, a team effort.
Right.
Because he was responsible for so much and so many people at that point, yet he still still went into the breach. And to me, that's a fascinating thing. It's hard to do. It's not easy to do. And every single day you have to redouble your efforts to be that guy.
Well, I think also, you know, he was thinking to himself, there's all these other Americans out there who are fighting and dying.
Right.
To preserve freedom, and so it's really my responsibility, my duty, to help them and not just sit back and hide, but to do my part and to do what I can do in this fight against the Nazis.
Yeah. And Steve, one thing that I loved reading over and over and over, you continue to travel a lot to the different conventions and the mm-hmm. meetings. And one of the things is Brian and I both have a evasion and escape background, both professionally and our private lives, which is really hard to understand now that we actually have a podcast and tell people where we are. But the idea is that I would assume that the story of this particular B-17 and this crew resonates with that community. And I bet they use it all the time. I bet you get hit up all the time about this story in that community. Would that be a true statement?
Oh, yeah. Since writing the book, it's totally changed my life.
Sure.
Because I retired, you know, I was just sleeping in and, you know, reading books and going for walks and taking naps. And then since I wrote this book, it's basically a full-time job. As you
right.
know, I go all over the country attending air shows, signing copies of my book. I make a lot of presentations, PowerPoint presentations. I got several of these coming up. And so it's basically a full-time job, but it's my passion. And it's about keeping the memory alive and educating people about what took place, especially trying to educate the younger generations.
I think it's a great point. That's a great point, Brian.
And yeah, and that's kind of what I was going to bring up next too, is that, you know, this, not, you know, your dad is part of a generation that there are not many left, right? There's not a lot of folks who fought in World War II that are still alive today. And part of that is preserving that memory, right?
Yes.
Carrying the stories forward. So like I do some work, and we've done, Greg and I as well, with a organization called Carry the Load. And same thing on Memorial Day, we go out and do certain things. On September 11th, we went to national cemeteries, cleaned headstones and stuff. And that's the whole thing, is that you their memory, that person, because you put up an image and you tell the story of who they were, you know, you get to a group of people that go, wow, like you just learn something about the history of your country that, you know, just paying it back to those who went before us. And if we don't keep that going, we forget about those things, and then history repeats itself. So that's the biggest part, which is why I'm sure for you it is a full-time job, because you've got to keep telling those stories now.
But I would go a step further, Brian. I would say that Steve's book, one of the things that really captured my imagination on Steve's book, the first reading, I'm sure I'm going to read it many times on an airplane, I'll leave some dog-eared copy in that seat back, is that the story is as relevant today as it was then. Yeah, okay, things are different, the aircraft and the technology and the countries being at war, but the ideals in that book about duty and honor and country and having faith and being able to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get back up every day, to me, that's the essence of resilience. And we're dealing with, a lot of our viewers and a lot of our listeners have PTSD. We certainly do. A lot of them are veterans and law enforcement professionals and first responders. So the reason that I really wanted to get you on the show is I think that they're going to benefit having the experience to read through and say, like Brian said earlier, hey, listen, I know I've endured a lot, but look at what these folks did. And not only were they able to endure it, but they were able to thrive and then ultimately flourish. I hope you see that, Steve, that your book is as relevant, I think, today as it was to the, you know, for these next upcoming generations.
Oh, without a doubt, for all those things you were just talking about. You know, they are the greatest generation, Brian. There were 16 million World War II veterans after the war, and there's less than 3% of those men that are still with us.
Yep.
And they're fading at a fast pace. So that's one of the big reasons I do what I do. That I'm all on the board of directors, actually immediate past president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association.
Right.
And it's our duty, or it's really our mission, to remember, honor, and educate. Remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and then to educate the public about it. And really, that's the purpose of my presentations that I make, and why I do what I do.
What's the biggest thing that kind of surprises you when you're going around taking the tours and talking to folks? Is there anything that comes up, or is there something that you hear all the time, or is there something common theme that you hear, or something that was surprising to you after you wrote the book?
Well, I think the thing that most comes up, because I mean, there's some groups I speak to that are really knowledgeable, you know, about World War II, but most of the groups I speak to, you know, very little about the 8th Air Force or the air war over Europe. And so they are fascinated by it, just to learn about what took place, you know, on an overall scope. But most people just aren't aware of what happens or what happened after these planes were shot down and all that occurred with, as far as the resistance, the underground, you know, escape and evasion. And that part of it, you know, you hear about, you know, the bombers bombing and being attacked by fighters, which, you know, happened in my book. But the book is unique from the standpoint that half of it takes place after the plane shot down on the ground. So that's rather unique, and to educate people about how brave those Belgian people were, or the French or the Dutch, who risked their lives aiding downed airmen, because they risked not only their lives, but those of their family and friends. Because if they were discovered by the Gestapo, you know, the German secret police, They'd be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the people who helped my dad and his crew did meet that fate. So they were unbelievably brave people. They saved my dad's life.
Yeah. Anybody that's ever been in Kermit, Texas, will love this book. Anybody that's ever had a BO, I'm telling you, Brian and I have both been there because we were teaching the ICE and U.S. Border Patrol and Attack and Borstar. So we're no stranger to that Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona area, specifically Kermit. And it's changed a little bit over the time. But I think that's fascinating. And I got to tell you too, Steve, that we're very selective about books for our reading list. One of the most common question that we get in our training and education is, hey, what do you read? What do you like? And we actually have this little reading list that we pass around and say, these are seminal books. These are our books that change the way I think about certain things. And I would add your book to that based on the fact that it is so many things. It's more than just history. It's more than a love story. It's more than being fascinated with World War II and the air war and the resistance. I think there's so much there about the human condition. And we teach human behavior pattern recognition and analysis. And one of the things that we always say is you have to understand humans if you're going to predict what they're going to do in a baseline. And for me, this is one of those books. This is definitely going on the reading list for me. Brian, how did you feel after you had the experience?
No, it's same thing. And you kind of summed it up there in terms of what it is to, you know, human performance, right? What is resilience? What is adaptability? What is, you know, we talk about a lot of that stuff maybe missing more today than it was back then, just simply due to the fact that life is much easier in 2019 for the average American, especially, but around the world as well, you know, than it was 50 years ago, than it was 60 years ago, you know, when folks were, you know, the whole country was involved in World War II. I mean, everyone was, whether you served or not, you were putting toward the effort in some way. And that kind of banded everyone together. And whether you suddenly, it wasn't about whether you liked your neighbor or not anymore. You're stuck in a situation together. You got to figure it out, right? And so we don't have as much of that experience. So I think it's good for everyone to kind of look back and go, well, look, these are the conditions that were going on. And this is what people just had to do. And some people did well and others didn't. And some people flourished in those situations. So that's what it is to me. It's just, it's a great, great story for all those different reasons. So I mean, what do you want, you know,
yeah, great
everyone's
question.
Biggest takeaway. What is it that you want to people to get out of it? I mean, I know it's got to be just to write this kind of story about your dad has got to be so cool. But overall, big picture, what is it that we want, you want people to take away from this?
Yeah, when I first decided to write the book, you know, I thought, well, it's going to be a book about my dad. But I quickly realized it wasn't a book about my dad.
It was much, much more.
Exactly. Much, much more. You know, it was about his whole crew. It was about all the guys in the 8th Air Force, really about all the guys who fought in World War II, the French resistance. And like you were saying, Greg, about, you know, the human condition.
Yes, sir.
And just to get the appreciation and realization of what those guys went through and the sacrifices that they made and the courage and that they had, and it is really the thing that gets to me. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II.
Right.
60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced, and it changed the course of the United States and the world forever.
Right.
So, you know, we can never forget the sacrifice of those young guys. And a lot of people, I think, another thing I try to get across is how different the world was back then, 75 years ago. I mean, there was no technology, basically.
Right.
You know, people that either read the newspaper that was, you know, old news, or they listened to the radio. The country was very rural back then. Most of the people lived out in the country, not in cities like today. A lot of these guys had never even been out of their county.
Yep.
You know, let alone all of a sudden they find themselves halfway across the world fighting in a war. You know, these guys were in their late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
A lot of them had never been away from home before, their mom. And all of a sudden, you know, they can do whatever they want to do. They can smoke, drink, you know, have sex.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a It was an exciting moment in these guys' lives, and really the defining moment of their lives. Any guy, it wasn't my dad for sure.
Yeah, that is so. So to go back to my comment earlier about, well, man, those guys probably had a lot harder than I did in mine. But then again, I didn't get to go running around Europe and get R&R and have drinks and hang out. Like, I didn't get that experience. So maybe it kind of evened out. It came out about the same. But I mean that and that's crazy. And I don't know if you want to mention any of that. Like, if you could, real quick. Give us some, like, for everyone listening, what it was actually like to be up in a B-17 on a bombing mission. Because everyone can maybe see,
fascinating.
Read books about, like, spy novels or people hiding out. So, man, I can kind of maybe.
Or built imagine. A model. In my age, everybody built that model. Everybody watched those shows. But being there was so different.
Yeah. So maybe just because I can imagine what it must be like to be on the run. That's got to be scary. But I mean, give us a context for what it's like just to fly a bombing mission in a B-17.
Right. Okay. Well, flying combat missions was brutal and extremely dangerous. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. At the peak, there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force located in an area in and around East Anglia, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were all only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you have hundreds of these bombers all taken off at the same time. And back then, there was no radar, there was no air traffic control, and usually the weather was crummy and it was overcast, socked in. They couldn't see anything until it got above the cloud layer. And so, mid-air collisions were not uncommon at all for these planes taken off. And then they had to form up these hundreds of bombers. It took them an hour to 2 hours to form up before they could ever cross the English Channel to begin their mission. And the planes weren't pressurized at that time. So above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen or else they'd pass out and could soon die. And it was extremely cold as well. It was minus 60 to 40 degrees below zero. Jeez. So frostbite was a huge problem. There were many airmen that were hospitalized for lengthy periods of time with serious frostbite injuries. And then they had to deal with the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. At the beginning of the war, the 8th Bomber Command didn't think these bombers needed any fighter support. They thought these heavily armed bombers, with 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns and flying in these tight formations could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. But the 8th Air Force was so sorely mistaken. They could not. In the early years of the war in 42, especially in 43, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Even though they implemented a mission limit of 25 and then you could go home. In the spring of 43, it was statistically impossible
to
complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown was only 6 before they got shot down.
Jeez.
And then they had to deal with anti-aircraft fire. The flak guns could shoot 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying. And so when you're going through that killing field, my dad said, even though it was so cold up there, when he'd go on the bomb run and have these flak shells exploding and the concussions from these shells just violently rocking the ship, that he'd just be sweating profusely and
dripping wet. I bet that would warm you up pretty quick.
Yeah. And then if they made it through the bomb run, then heading back to their bases in England, they'd have to encounter the Luftwaffe again. So it was really tough flying these combat missions. And then they'd come home and then they'd have to go right back out, not knowing if the next one would be their last. So it took a lot of courage and determination to keep going back up there, never knowing if you might be not coming home.
I think it's a testament to your father, to his crew, to their B-17, to all people that have served at one time or another. Anybody that served their country in this type of capacity has had either shell shock or PTSD. It's just goes with the territory. The other thing is that even Luftwaffe, even the members of the German Air Force mentioned that these planes they could take so much damage. They couldn't believe it. And they could shoot back. I mean, Brian and I have had a load clear reduced stoppage and, do the timing and headspace on an M2 HB 50 Cal. and the barrel weighs 90 pounds. Mm-hmm. And these guys had to carry a dozen and more of those on and off the ship and change them out. And, you know, what they had to deal with in such close proximity and the unknown, the war in Europe was going, and then Pearl Harbor, and now we have the war against the Japanese, and the Russians, we weren't sure what Stalin was going to do, and Truman had his hands full, and here comes this one crew that says, not us and not today. To me, fascinating. I think it's a great read for anybody that wants it. It's the perfect Christmas gift, and Christmas is definitely coming up. Brian, I want to thank you for being able to bring Steve on the show, and Steve, I want to thank you if in some small way we can reach out to all those communities that you touch every day and tell them about the great work that you've done in this book and how it helps breed resilience and helps open up some doors to conversations with our kids about our history. I think that's one of the next benefits of the book.
Well, it was gratifying going out to Belgium for this trip. I went on a quest to find relatives of all my dad's crew that I was successful in doing. And there were about 28 relatives of the crew that went over for the celebrations this last month. And most of those were third generation, grandkids.
The kids of the guys.
So that was really nice. 5 years ago, it was mostly second generation relatives of the crew. But this year, it was mostly third generation. So getting those younger generations involved and getting appreciation for what their relatives or ancestors did was, really, really gratifying. And then the other thing, of course, after the Belgium, I went over to Munich, Germany to revisit Hans Berger, the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane, which is
that's incredible.
A real thrill to see him again.
That's incredible.
Fascinating story. From a page turner from the beginning to the end. Lucky enough, and Steve, I got to tell you, I didn't think we were going to nail you for the broadcast. I'm so lucky that that you said yes, and thankful that you said yes, and that Brian is like the vision of the future. Brian looks forward and backwards with equal aplomb. I haven't learned that yet. So Brian, your vision to bring Steve on as well, I applaud both.
Yeah, I really, I'm going to go ahead and when I'm going to loop that on, I got that on record, so I'm going to loop that because
it dissolved.
Greg doesn't normally say anything positive about me, but I think maybe
that's a compliment, Brian.
Of the moment, maybe right now, he's a little overcome by emotion.
I'm overwhelmed.
Finally something nice came out. But Steve, we appreciate you coming on here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've had a great time. I appreciate what you guys are doing. It's really important. And, thank you so much for reading the book and having me on the show and talking with you today.
Steve, I certainly hope you'll be that you'll come on again. I think you're a fascinating guest. I think we'd love to talk to you more. So perhaps we'll extend an invitation and we hope that you'll accept in the future.
Absolutely. Be my pleasure. Thank you.